And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. And this is going to be a great one. But before I get into the podcast itself, I want to speak directly to listeners. If you have not already subscribed to the Hank Unplugged podcast, subscribe right away. That will ensure that you never miss a single Hank Unplugged podcast. And secondly, every single review matters. My goal for the Hank Unplugged podcast is to bring the most interesting, the most informative, the most inspirational individuals on the planet to as many people as possible. So here's your action step to make a difference. Leave a review on iTunes or wherever you consume your favorite podcasts. And let me add that 95% of all the reviews we've had since the very beginning of the podcast have been 5 stars. But when you leave your review and a 5-star rating, it helps expand our audience. And in the process, many, many more people around the globe are equipped, ready always, to give an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within them, with gentleness and with respect. Today's podcast features Dr. Jonathan Witt. He is a former English professor, now a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He is a prolific writer, one of my favorite guests on the Bible Answer Man broadcast. He is co-author of the very book that we are now making available to those people who support the ministry. It's titled Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin to Design. He's also co-authored A Meaningful World, How the Arts and Sciences Reveal the Genius of Nature, The Hobbit Party, The Vision of Freedom that Tolkien got, but the West forgot. That is something that is ripe for picking. We want to talk about that later on. But he's also authored many popular and academic articles. He's scripted several documentaries that have appeared on PBS. He served as the lead writer for the Poverty Cure series and the award-winning film Poverty Incorporated, which is something that I definitely want to get into today. He has contributed to our own Christian Research Journal. And as I said, he is a favorite guest of mine. And I am just delighted, Dr. Witt, to have you on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Oh, I love coming on your show, Hank. You're such a thoughtful host. The conversations we've had in the past have been so good. My only regret is I'm not there in the studio with you like I was when we did A Meaningful World.
That was a fantastic time on the Bible Answer Man broadcast. And, you know, that's one of my favorite books as well, How the Arts and Sciences Revealed the Genius of Nature. And I think that's something that a lot of people miss. We live in a meaningful world, and you're using that as a double entendre. I mean, you're pointing out that this world is full of meaning.
Yeah, it's, you know, like Jesus says that, you know, when you are good soil and you follow Jesus, you're going to be blessed, and it's going to press down and flow over. Well, this universe, this world is overflowing with meaning, and scientists keep digging deeper and deeper and finding new layers of it. It's just extraordinary.
Your PhD is in English. How did you get involved in the intelligent design movement?
Well, I got at it through, my PhD was actually in a branch of English, of philosophy, a hybrid, so to speak, and it was aesthetics, the philosophy of aesthetics. And I had a friend who was already in the ID movement, and I was interested in it, so I'd been following it from the side. And I noticed that Darwinists often made these odd aesthetic arguments against intelligent design. The aesthetic assumptions they were making had no basis in any branch of aesthetics, of literary theory, of artistic theory, and there are some crazy, crazy artistic, you know, postmodern notions out there. But they were even off the reservation for these. And so I wrote an article for Touchstone magazine called "The Gods Must Be Tidy," and I pointed up all these problems, and that caught the eye of Stephen Meyer at Discovery Institute. And one thing led to another, and so I've been with them ever since.
Some of the most incredible colleagues imaginable.
Yeah, I'm so blessed because, you know, I've got right at my, you know, email fingertips. If I have any kind of questions, if I write something and I want to vet it with a, you know, leading, you know, say a Cambridge-trained molecular protein biologist. I can get that in front of him, and on down the list. It's, Jonathan Wells, Stephen Meyer. It's an unbelievable group of scientists to have the privilege to work with.
And they're making a difference all over the planet. I mean, I love the intelligent design movement. It has obviously been under a lot of fire, but unjustly so. The intelligent design movement is, I think, the premier movement today from a Christian perspective, which follows evidence wherever that evidence leads. And I think that that unbiased way of following evidence is setting a pattern for scholarship in general.
Yeah, we just follow the evidence where it leads. Most of the people in the ID movement are theists. Most of them are Christians. Not all. We have some Jewish scholars. We have some people that came to ID from being agnostic, and like Antony Flew, who's a famous philosopher atheist. But most of us are theists. And, we point out that it's the materialist, naturalist, atheist scientists. They're not free to follow the evidence either to a kind of a natural cause for some mystery in the natural world or to a design cause, whereas we're free to accept either possibility because God can work through direct, action, or he can work through secondary causes. And so the scientist who's a theist and lets his theism inform his science, as the founders of modern science did, Kepler and all these great early scientists, we're open to either possibility. So we're the ones that are the more open-minded, and we urge people to take that more open-minded view when they're considering the evidence for design.
There's so much I want to talk to you about today, but one of the things that really caught my attention was Poverty Incorporated, or Poverty Inc. You served as the lead writer for this documentary, and I thought it was an absolutely stunning, eye-opening piece. I was thinking back to 1964, because I'm writing about that right now. We had the idea then, Lyndon Baines Johnson, of the Great Society, of putting an end to poverty. We can end poverty, he said. How did that work out? We had the wrong paradigm.
Yeah, it was not the best approach.
Yeah, it wasn't the best approach. And in economics, good intentions are worthless. What is needed is knowledge. Ideas have consequences. And the way we've gone about dealing with the issue of poverty around the world has been a broken paradigm.
Absolutely. I mean, and it goes back to, it goes back to worldview. And a lot of the worldview that fed this approach is that humans are basically mouths. We're consumers, and so we have a fixed pie, and so the only thing we can do is figure out how to better divide up the pie to help poverty. It misses the fact that humans are creators. This goes back to Judeo-Christian theology. Humans are made in the image of an extraordinary creator. We are creators made in the image of a creator, and so we can grow the pie, which is, of course, the history of the West, since the, late Middle Ages on into the Industrial Revolution. The planet couldn't have supported, billions of people before we started creating wealth through our ingenuity. So once you bring that back into the picture and you view the poor not as just victims, not as mouths, but as potential creators with capacity, it changes everything about how you approach, broken situations where there's extreme poverty.
Yeah, your problem doesn't seem to be with humanitarian aid. Your objection in that film is that when humanitarian aid becomes an industry, we're all in trouble.
Right. Then you have the other human, fallen human problem of wanting to propagate the industry. And that can often become more important to people than actually. Well, because, for instance, if you solve poverty in, say, Haiti, well, then the poverty industry is out of business in Haiti. I'm not saying that there's a bunch of malevolent people down there wanting to keep Haiti poor, but you just end up with so many people going down these ruts, doing the same thing over and over, that it's easier just to stay in the ruts than to stop and say, wait a minute, some of what we're doing is bad. We need to radically change our approach. That's tough. Bill Clinton, I have a lot of issues with Bill Clinton, his presidency. But later, he, and I think this comes up in the film, he apologized for his policy toward Haiti, where they dumped rice unnaturally low-cost rice on Haiti and put a lot of their rice farmers out of business. Said, well, it's good for my rice farmers in Arkansas, but it was bad for Haiti. So we were treating Haitians as victims, as unable to deal with their own problems, and we went in there and took hardworking farmers and knocked them out of business. A lot of them ended up moving into Port-au-Prince. There was this huge rush into Port-au-Prince, sadly, right before that giant earthquake. So, you know, tragedy compounded on tragedy.
And there are these new social entrepreneurs like Tom Shoes, a great example. Again, I don't think that it is our place to judge anyone's motives, but it is sort of the hipster poverty machine where you have people in places around the world producing goods and services. And all of a sudden, you have this big, shiny truck that drives in full of shoes. How can anyone in the culture compete with free? They can't. And so they put the local entrepreneurs out of business.
Right. Yeah, it's not just the rice farmers. You see it at a lot of different levels. And then Tom's Shoes, you know, those shoes, they'll bring those into these villages, and those shoes are like, you know, they're nice mall shoes, but it's kind of almost silly imagining some little kid in some muddy village, you know, being able to wear those more than just a few weeks. So there's some kind of disconnect. And we tried to point that out very gently because, you know, we appreciate Tom's Shoes, you know, trying to do good. And I think they have been trying to make some adjustments. I heard that they were trying to move some of their factories into countries they were trying to help. So actually try to create some jobs in those places. But there's probably more effective ways to do that. And we highlighted some of those. You know, there's there in Haiti, for example, there's that indigenous couple of guys that were doing solar panels. Solar panels are actually much more strategic in countries like Haiti because it's so sunny and they don't already have an electrical infrastructure. And those guys were making great progress. And then they nearly got put out of business, first by the earthquake, but then they managed to push through that. But then by the flood of free solar panels that came in after the earthquake, when nobody thought to check, wait, is there anybody in Haiti that makes solar panels and installs solar panels? In fact, there was a couple of guys there that were very good at it, had a team, and knew Haiti, knew the system, and were probably the best at it. But they weren't getting any, you know, any attention because who knew that Haitians could do solar power? So there's kind of a paternalism there people aren't even aware of that leads them sometimes to grossly underestimate the capacity of the poor in some of these developing countries.
And, of course, then those poor people are being turned into economic slaves.
Right, yeah. They often get, the system. And there's it's not all the external, you know, Western aid system. We also talk about the importance of rule of law. You know, some of these countries don't have property rights and rule of law for the poor. And we talk about, you know, if you can get property rights for the poor, even if they don't have much money, if they have just a little bit and they can call their little plot of land theirs, it starts opening up all kinds of possibilities for them. And so that's another thing we emphasize.
Yeah, I suppose at the root of it all, it is the difference between teaching someone to fish and giving that person a fish. So if the donor or the charity organizations were equipping people to be fishermen, then they would be fed in perpetuity. If you just
right.
give them a fish, they become very, very dependent on these donor organizations. And there was one example in the film, I don't remember all the details, but a particular church was helping out a particular region of the world, and within that region, a particular number of people, and they gave, and the people in the church with great hearts gave to this particular thing. Well, then the emphasis for the church changed. So these people who had become dependent on their donations all of a sudden didn't have those donations, and they didn't know what else to do. So now they're in a worse situation than they were before.
Right. I think the example was Rwanda, you know, after the genocide, they came in, oh, let's provide eggs. Well, they provided eggs and put this local guy there, a Rwandan who was selling eggs in his village, put him out of business. And then they went on to the next fad thing, and he was still out of business, and the village didn't have local eggs, either free or for sale from the guy. So yeah, it's tough. It's tough being smart when you don't have local knowledge. So that's another thing we emphasize. There's ways to help. There's ways to partner. But you've got to do the hard work of going in there, developing local knowledge, seeing the people there, you know, as having capacity, having wisdom, having insight. If you don't do that, it's just, you're going to have all kinds of unintended consequences.
All kinds of unintended consequences. That's right. How is the present war on poverty another permutation of colonialism? I mean, I thought that was another point that was pretty poignant in the film.
Well, there's a couple different ways you could go with that, because you could never run out of examples of people doing goofy, misguided stuff. But if you look at the statistics overall, there is where countries are getting a little bit more rule of law, they're getting a little bit more economic freedom, the average standard of living for even the bottom quartile is going up. And so I think it was back in the 80s, 58% of the world lived on $1.25 or less a day, and this is adjusted for inflation. And then 35 years later, that's down to, I think, 22-24%. So that's some serious progress. That we have a long way to go. We live in a fallen world. I don't think we're ever going to completely get rid of poverty. There's going to be wars and nasty dictators and such. But we've made tremendous progress, and where we've seen that progress, it's where countries have made leaps toward providing economic freedom, providing, a measure of property rights, places like China and India, which, still have huge problems, but they're way ahead of where they were, 30, 40 years ago. And it's not because they got more socialist, it's because they got more economic freedom.
Yeah. You talk about the nasty dictators. I mean, I thought that was another poignant insight in the film itself. Oftentimes the problem is with the distribution system. So all this stuff gets dumped over into these foreign countries, and then it doesn't really get distributed to the people that need it. Instead, the money and the goods go to dictators who use it for their own self-aggrandizement.
Right, yeah. You can, we'll give to this dictator, and then we'll work out. Maybe he'll be friendlier. And, a lot of times it just ends up paying for guns and, better fed soldiers and creates problems. So you've got, and it's heartbreaking to think, we can't get it to the people, so it's easy to not want to think about that. Just think, we gave it to the government and that we're doing such good, now let's go on to something else. But you've got to do the hard work of tracking it, finding out what's happening, finding out what the consequences are.
I hope a lot of people watch this film. It's one of the reasons I wanted to draw attention to it. The moment I watched it, I immediately determined that I wanted my whole family to see it and other people within my sphere of influence to see it as well. And I thought you did a great job as the lead writer on that particular documentary. Just one other question about that, and that is, how has this film made a difference in the way humanitarian aid is administered? Because at the end of the film, you get a sense that even people like Bono have changed their way of looking at poverty as a result of the enlightenment that is produced by a lot of the people involved in or featured in this film.
I think there is a sea change, and it's one of those deals where you want to take all the credit. Our film, and we also did a DVD series, kind of a church mission group series called Poverty Cure. And we have a Poverty Cure website about a year before that that also got some play. And so, it's tempting to say, all these changes we're seeing are because of our film. And I do hope that they did have an impact. I suspect that we were at the leading edge of a host of people who were waking up to the need to do things differently, and that we've just helped amplify that. And so I do think there's a sea change. There's always going to be people that want to stay in the old rut, want to keep it the way it is because it maybe feathers their nest. But I do think there's even more internationally. You'll often get people stateside who take a more enlightened view of helping the poor internationally than they take for helping the poor here in the United States. So they have this interesting kind of schizophrenia. But at least they're making progress as they think about the poor internationally.
And again, I thought that the film did a very, very good job of not being, overly dogmatic. I thought the film had a nice balance to it, showing people as they were going through progression themselves. They have great, great hearts. they just had a broken paradigm. And as they started seeing that their paradigm was broken, they started changing their methods. So rather than beat up someone like Bono, who's done a tremendous amount of good and really does work out of good motives when it comes to the poverty issue, he's been enlightened. And that enlightenment, that change of path, you mentioned Clinton as well. I'm not a Clinton fan, but I thought it was really great that he forthrightly communicated that he had been working with a system that really wasn't the right system to be working with.
Yeah, those are real victories for the poor internationally when prominent men like that say, hey, you know what? This wasn't working, this approach, this paternalistic attitude, this airdropping aid without local knowledge, without an appreciation for the capacity there. That's not working. We've got to take a different approach. Those are huge victories, very encouraging. And I hope those guys will do more. You know, I'd love to see Bono, you know, leaning into that, those insights he made even more. And of course, there's huge currents trying to keep him from doing that because there's so much vested interest in keeping the system the way it is. So, you know, pray for Bono.
Absolutely. Hey, one other thing that comes to mind, and that is the Marshall Plan. You want to talk a little bit about the deficits of the Marshall Plan?
Oh, yeah. The Marshall Plan, it's often held up as the shining example of foreign aid working. So after World War II, you know, Europe had been decimated by the war. And we came in with the Marshall Plan to help reignite, restart Europe. And it's presented as this great success story. And then they said, oh, we can apply the Marshall Plan to other countries. Well, a couple of problems. One is we don't know how quickly Europe would have jumped back on its feet without the Marshall Plan. We can't go visit an alternate universe where we didn't. So it's conjecture as to how quickly they would have gotten back on their feet. But the other issue is that Europe had, relatively speaking, much more developed rule of law, property rights, a lot of the key things we point to as, you know, being the sort of thing that's going to help people grow and create wealth. And I know we think today about all the dysfunction in the European Union, but if you go back to the mid-late 40s and early 50s, those European countries compared to, say, some highly dysfunctional, you know, developing world government were way ahead in terms of property rights, rule of law, that sort of thing. And so they were poised to benefit from aid in ways that, say, a country run by a corrupt dictator would not be. And so you have to be careful drawing too many analogies. And what we argue in the film is that was a problem. Is that people said, oh, the Marshall Plan worked. Now let's go do that all over the world. And it didn't map nearly as well into these developing countries that had these problems. We had to go, what we needed to do is go in and partner with those people in government who are wanting to improve property rights, that sort of thing. There's a guy, Hernando de Soto in Peru. We talk more about him in our Poverty Cure series. He's done great things in Peru and in some of the neighboring countries like Chile to improve property rights. And like Chile, you know, we tend to focus in the news about all the basket case countries, you know, like Venezuela. But you look over at Chile and they've made great strides because they've, you know, gotten better at honoring property rights, at extending property rights to the poor, that sort of thing. So there are success stories.
Yeah, absolutely. My son worked in Chile, and he's told me about many of those success stories. I want to get back to this book that I mentioned at the outset of the podcast, Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin to Design. It's the story of Matti Laisola, and I thought that the book was terrific. And as I was reading through it, I kind of saw your fingerprints all over it. So I suppose that you're really the person that's writing most of the material in that book. I want to get to one of the choice passages, and I'm actually going to quote it or read it and have you comment, because I love this particular segment. But anyway, this is what is written. I think you wrote it. You can tell me later on. But this is what you find in Heretic. Evolution is slow and gradual, except when it's fast. It is dynamic and creates huge changes over time, except when it keeps everything the same for millions of years. It explains both extreme complexity and elegant simplicity. It tells us how birds learn to fly. and how some lost that ability. Evolution made cheetahs fast and turtles slow. It diverges except when it converges. It produces exquisitely fine-tuned designs except when it produces junk. Evolution is random and without direction except when it moves towards a target. Life under evolution is a cruel battlefield except when it demonstrates altruism. Evolution explains virtue and vice, love and hate, religion and atheism, and it does all of this with a growing number of ancillary hypotheses. Modern evolution is the Rube Goldberg of theoretical constructs. And what is the result of all this speculative ingenuity? Like the defunct theory of phlogiston, it explains everything without explaining anything very well. I thought that is just about as good as it gets.
Yeah, and that Monty and I, we worked on it together. He had kind of said, hey, let's do something along these lines, and he gave me a little bit, and then we kind of built it up together. But it's hard not to have fun with that while making a serious point, because it does. It's just this ridiculously supple that could explain anything. They could explain something, and then there could be some new evidence. Oh, it turns out that's the opposite. Oh, well, Darwinism explains that too. So it explains nothing because it explains, you know, too much. We mentioned phlogiston. Phlogiston was this mysterious substance that turned out not to exist, you know, starting back in the, you know, 1600s at least, perhaps even further back. And it was supposed to be this mysterious substance that was released when you burned a substance. But then they found that, wait, oxide of tin gets heavier after you burn it, the starting material. So what's going on there? Oh, well, sometimes phlogiston must have negative weight. And so, you know, they would come up with all these patches, these ridiculous patches, until eventually, you know, hundreds of years later, when there was plenty of evidence to have gotten rid of it a long time ago, finally it collapsed. Well, Darwinism has all these patches. You know, it's like the epicycles they kept adding to the geocentric view of the universe to try to keep it propped up as they kept finding examples in astronomy that didn't fit with it. So when the theory gets that festooned and that complicated, then it's time to step back and be willing to be skeptical about it.
Talk about the difference between science and scientism.
Well, that's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, scientism has this grand progress narrative, purely natural, purely material explanations inevitably will arise and grow stronger. Design arguments will inevitably collapse under the weight of new discoveries. And so you have this perpetual bent towards not science, but scientism.
Yeah, and one of the favorite tricks of those who are proponents of scientism is to get you to conflate scientism with science. And science is just a careful, methodical way of studying the natural world. You pose a hypothesis, you find ways to test it, you revise your hypothesis or discard it. There are different branches of science that have overlapping but distinct methodologies. But scientism, as you nicely summarized there, has this grand materialistic narrative that science can explain everything, that the natural world is all there is, that matter and energy is all there is. You know, atoms in the void, you know, if you will, are the ultimate reality. And so there's this worldview, it's a kind of, you know, atheistic religion masquerading as objective science. So one of the things Marty and I did as we went through there is just try to keep those distinct and urge readers, don't fall for that conflation. Those are two separate things.
And evolution has some pretty dark secrets. Talk about the evolutionary dark secret.
Yeah, evolution has a lot of tricks up its sleeve, too. One is just the term evolution. It can mean so many different things. It can mean something as innocuous as change over time, which I've yet to meet somebody that doesn't think there's been change over, you know, the course of history and prehistory in the natural world. It can mean, point to things like the beak sizes of Galapagos finches changing subtly, or the ratio of peppered moss with darker light wings changing in the face of, say, pollution in parts of England, that's microevolution. So they'll often trot out examples of microevolution and say, look, we've proved evolution. You're like, wait a minute, that's microevolution. Darwin's theory wasn't about microevolution. Everybody already knew that microevolution happened. His theory is that there was unguided evolution of all life forms from a single first cell. And so they'll conflate those and play games with those two meanings. So those are some at least a couple of key dark secrets in the evolutionary closet. Another is the fossil record. I testified in Texas because Texas had some standards for teaching biology that said, you know what? We helped get these installed in an earlier period. You know, when you're teaching kids about the fossil record in the biology class, go ahead and let them know that there's this pattern of abrupt appearance of new major forms that just seem to kind of pop into the fossil record without, you know, the long prehistory of evolution leading to them that you would expect. And then many of these just stay there. There was a snake just the other day. It came up in the news. They found an amber, preserved in amber, that was ridiculously old, you know, but by their time measurement system. And it had virtually the identical form that snakes do today, that particular form of snake. So evolution hadn't changed it at all. And it had just kind of popped into the fossil record out of nothing, which isn't the pattern that we should expect. You know, Darwin said we should see this gradually branching tree of life, and we should see more and more evidence of that in the fossil record. But instead, we get this pattern of abrupt appearance and stasis. Well, the Darwinists came and said, we want to strip those out of the standards. We don't want to confuse their poor little young minds with this abrupt appearance and stasis, because that's just a trick for the ID people, intelligent design people, to get students to doubt evolution. Well, we countered and said, we want them to grapple with the evidence and let them know the strengths and weaknesses of evolutionary theory, and let them think critically about it. You know, wherever they land, they're going to be better scientists for grappling with the real evidence and not just an airbrush version of evolution.
Yeah, and many of the often cited examples of evolution involve devolution. And in those cases, an organism or a molecular machine devolves in a way that gives it a niche advantage, but at the cost of overall fitness.
Yeah, my co-author, Matti Lassola, who's a very successful bioengineer in Finland. He spent several years in Switzerland. He was both at very respected universities and also in private industry doing you know, cutting-edge work with proteins, with enzymes. And he said a lot of the best thing they did when they would go in and accelerate random, you know, evolution on enzymes, you know, with, you know, bombarding them with certain things, is like finally they'd get something a little useful, but it was always like it would break something. And I think it's Michael Behe gives the example of, you know, you could have a rusty lock on a door that rusts shut, and depending on your situation, that might actually be useful. You might not have any need to go in and out of that door, but you might want it to be very secure. And so now it's really hard to get through, harder than before when you just had a flimsy little lock on it. But you're not going to build a house with rust just because that rusted door provided this niche advantage. And that's the kind of small, positive, beneficial mutations that Michael Behe's talked about in The Edge of Evolution. He's got another book coming that'll be very exciting. So what Matti Lassola saw in all his enzyme research, you'll get these little changes that will create a niche advantage. But when you go and look at what the change was, it's something got broken or jammed, and that created a niche benefit. You know, a lot of bacteria that develop antibiotic resistance, when you take away the antibiotic, that antibiotic-resistant bacteria gets outcompeted by the more common strain of bacteria. So it basically, that antibiotic-resistant bacteria lost some sort of overall functionality to become a specialist. It's like a greyhound dog is not going to outcompete a wolf in the wild. You know, its ancestor, a wolf in the wild, it's going to be able to outsprint it, but the wolf's going to outcompete it, you know, 10-1 if you just throw a batch of greyhounds and a batch of wolves on an island. You're going to come back 20 years later, and you're probably mostly going to have wolves.
You know, you sort of alluded to this earlier on. You mentioned Darwin's Tree of Life, and I think that, you know, underscores a very, very significant issue, and that is you have these icons, and inevitably icons turn into the argument. So instead of having a defensible argument, you just make these dogmatic assertions, and oftentimes you don't even assert anything. You simply point at the icon.
Right, yeah. There's, and we touched on a few of those. One of the new ones that's really come to light, and it's not brand new, but my colleague Jonathan Wells, in his recent book Zombie Science, he highlighted it's the eye, the vertebrate eye. You know, humans are vertebrates, and so we have this kind of eye. You'll get, you know, Oxford biologist Richard Dawkins, you'll get these very, you know, there's a guy named Lentz who's come out with a book recently, will say, well, the human eye, the vertebrate eye, is wired backwards. It's crazy. It creates this tiny little blind spot. No intelligent designer would have done it that way, but Darwinism would. Darwinism is a makeshift, tinkering, you know, trial and error, random process. So we shouldn't be surprised that it creates this weird backward wiring. But a designer, an all-wise God, wouldn't. Well, they've known, eye specialists in biology have known for, I think, decades, that this backward wiring actually dramatically improves oxygen flow, which is very important for these very oxygen-hungry eye cells we have in our eyes, which are just extraordinary. They were doing a recent research in, it was like a quantum mechanics type test, but they needed the human eye, and maybe they were using some other animal eye, to detect a single photon. Can you imagine? Photons are insanely small. I mean, they make electrons look like, you know, boulders. But apparently the vertebrate eye can detect a single photon. And of course it's very, and it's able to get all that oxygen it needs. It does all this amazing stuff. It's light years ahead of any, you know, human, you know, camera technology. There's a good reason for that backward wiring. It's constrained optimization, a basic engineering concept. And then you get guys like Richard Dawkins that think they just have this slam dunk icon. Look at the backward wiring of the eye. That's Darwinism. That's not intelligent design. They don't even bother. They're so sure of themselves, or at least maybe they're so afraid of the evidence for design that they don't even engage the other side enough to realize that they're trotting out very threadbare arguments.
You know, what you ought to do is elaborate a little bit on this constrained optimization. A lot of people hear that. They're not sure what that is. But, I mean, I think it's an incredibly important concept for people to grab a hold of.
Yeah, well, like right now I've got some notes from our discussion here in front of me on my notebook computer. What if somebody walked in and says, yeah, notebook computer's lame, man. I've got a TV in my living room that has a 58-inch screen. Your notebook computer only has a, you know, 15, 17-inch screen. We would think the person, you know, needed to be, you know, have something very basic explained to them. This notebook computer, I can take it. I can go to the coffee shop with it. I can take it with me on trips. I can go upstairs. I can go downstairs. I can move out to my backyard with it. The screen's big enough for 95, 98% of the purposes I need. If I want to, I can plug into a bigger screen. So it's constrained optimization. If they designed it with a huge screen, it wouldn't be portable. And so hopefully at that point, the person, a light bulb would go on. And so that's constrained optimization. You know, you can have a sports car that maneuvers and it's, you know, fast. It hugs the road very well. Accelerates incredibly well. But it's not going to have the best gas mileage. It's not going to have the best storage capacity. There was a constrained optimization or trade-off that had to be made to make it the best sports car. Just, you know, same with a pickup, same with, you know, some other kind of car, fuel economy car. So with that eye, the designer said, you know what, I'm going to do some amazing things in terms of what this eye is going to be able to see. It's going to make those light-sensitive cells very oxygen-hungry. I'm going to go in and backward wire. It's going to create this tiny little blind spot, which then gets fixed because you've got two eyes, and most people don't even know they have a blind spot. It's so minor. It's so inconsequential. So there's this tiny little negative trade-off for this huge positive. And so that's a classic example of skilled constrained optimization. So you'll often have engineers that are much more likely to be pro-intelligent design because they intuitively get this constrained optimization concept. They intuitively see a brilliant work of engineering and they say, that had to be designed.
You have written so much. I mean, I think about the articles you've written for Touchstone, for the Princeton Theological Review, for the Oxford Literature and Theology, for the Seattle Times, for the Kansas City Star, for Breakpoint. I mean, I go on and on. You have written so many articles, but there's an interesting article that caught my attention in which you analyze the results of a recent survey that suggests that Americans reject evolution. Why? Because they are simply uninformed. Talk about that.
Oh, right. Yeah, there was a survey. I can't remember the university, but it was a study. It was in bioscience. They reported on the survey. And they concluded that, hey, the more literate young people are about science and the more you expose them and teach them about evolution, the more they accept evolutionary theory. And so the unstated implication was, maybe it was stated at some point, was, well, that's what we'd expect because there's all this great evidence for evolution. And once you can just get people past some of the goofy objections, they will accept it. But I went into, you know, having with my background in English and in wordsmithing and language, I went and took a careful look at the survey, and I very quickly started seeing problems. For instance, they would, when they were trying to find out what a person's view is, they would leave out key possibilities, like there really wasn't for instance, an old earth creationist view, which anybody that spends 20 minutes in the creation ID evolution landscape will be aware that there's a significant group of people that think the universe is old, but God created it. There isn't common descent evolution. God's designing things. He designed humans independently. So that immediately set off warning bells. And then another time, another place in the survey, they were implying that they were saying that there was this correlation between understanding evolution and acceptance. But then the way they worded some of the questions, you really had to buy into evolution to get the answer right. So that the questions conflated understanding and acceptance. It would be like asking a question, do you agree that LeBron James is the greatest basketball player, in fact, the greatest athlete who has ever lived? And somebody, you know, answering, you know, no, I think it was Michael Jordan or Pele or whatever. Oh, they don't understand basketball. They don't accept that LeBron James is the greatest. Well, that doesn't tell you if understanding basketball and accepting LeBron James is the greatest. You know, you're conflating things. So there were weird things like that. And the sort of thing sort of mistakes bright people could only make if they had been extremely insulated from the other position, if they'd had no meaningful contact and conversations, iron sharpening iron, with any pro-intelligent design people.
That's one of the problems, though, and I think it bears elaboration. You think about the fact that we live in an age of information overload. There's so much information being pumped down the pike, and you never really have an opportunity to process it. And as a result of that, people don't know how to think anymore.
Yeah, that's a separate problem, but it's a big problem, is that people mistake being able to bounce around the internet and have their fingers on any little bit of trivia, mistake that for learning, for wisdom. I think, you know, parents, educators, we've got to recognize that there's this serious problem with you know, kids not learning to kind of dive deep, be quiet. You know, what was it that Pascal said? You know, all of men's troubles derived from this is inability to sit still in a room. Well, that gets, you know, doubled and trebled when the person's sitting still in a room with a you know, with an iPhone in front of him or her.
I want to get back to one of your books that is an all-time favorite at the Christian Research Institute, A Meaningful World. I mentioned it at the outset of the podcast, but this book is subtitled How the Arts and Sciences Reveal the Genius of Nature. How do the arts and sciences reveal the genius of nature?
Yeah, what we did in that book, Ben Weicker and I, is we went through and showed that you can go across cultures and across mediums, you know, whether it's literature or painting. We spent most of our time in literature because that was my background. We argued that there are these certain common markers that, you know, you find for works that are designated, you know, widely widely dismissed as a work of genius, whether it's, you know, Dante's Divine Comedy or Shakespeare's work, or, you know, a great, you know, symphony or opera by Mozart. There's depth to it. You know, you might say richness, but there's this depth where you can keep digging and finding, you know, riches there, wisdom, insight, beauty. There's this radiant clarity to it. You know, you kind of understand the world or feel the world in a new way, or you become re-familiarized, or you become reawakened to some beauty that you'd become deadened to because of the work of art. There's a harmony. There's an elegance. So we went through and explained those, and we gave some examples from Shakespeare's Hamlet, his comedy Much Ado About Nothing. And then we showed, okay, so Shakespeare, you know, he's considered, you know, maybe the greatest playwright, you know, in all the world, certainly, you know, in the English-speaking world. And so now let's go over to nature and see if we find these markers. And of course, we went through and showed that you find these markers of depth, radiant clarity, harmony, and elegance. You find them in a far greater degree in biology and chemistry and astronomy, physics, you know, all across the board. So we said, it's not just evidence of design that we find. We find evidence of extraordinarily ingenious design, and we should bring the same attitude. You know, if you have if you have somebody that say, "Hey, this person's a genius," and you can learn a lot from them. Oh no, they're probably just idiots. You know, they're probably old-fashioned idiots. They're not going to learn. They're not going to gain any wisdom. They're not going to have the patience to study that person carefully. If you approach nature with that attitude, oh, nature's stupid. It's just Darwinian evolution, and it does crazy, stupid stuff. You're not going to be patient and look for those layers of genius. And we talk about how the founders of modern science, they believed in a rational creator who was a mastermind. And so they went digging for those hidden riches. We said, that's the attitude. There's abundant evidence nature is the work of genius. Go to nature as a young scientist, go to nature with that expectation that there's a genius here whose wisdom outstrips mine, but I'm made in his image. So there's even a theological connection here that they were able to draw upon the early scientists. I'm made in his image, so there's some hope, even though I'm not anywhere near as intelligent as him, there's hope that I can connect with and uncover some of that ingenious order that he put into nature as he created it.
Yeah, the perspective is so important. You wrote an intriguing article for the Christian Research Journal, and by the way, it's up on the web at equip.org. It's titled Darwin Versus Beauty, Explaining Away the Butterfly. And in that article, you point out that a first step in understanding Darwinism's response to beauty, like the beauty of the butterfly or beauty in general, is to recognize that Darwinism seeks to explain away our experience of it. And that is a horrendous evil.
Yeah, Darwin, to his credit, he recognized that his theory of natural selection, evolution by, you know, random mutation and natural selection, it did a very poor job of explaining all this extravagant beauty in the biological realm, whether it's butterflies or the peacock tail. And so he came along with this patch theory, sexual selection. That was his The Descent of Man went into that. And so his patch was basically, well, for those things, for those extravagant forms of beauty we find, it's sexual selection. You know, often say the female is picking, say with a peacock, is picking that more dramatic and beautiful peacock tail. And so there's multiple problems with that. One is it really just backs up the problem. Why would nature, if natural selection is driving things at the base, why would nature select a peahen with these highly impractical tastes in peacocks? I mean, you've seen the peacocks, they can fly, but those hugely long tails cannot possibly help them get off faster. It's amazing that they can fly at all with those. So there's this impracticality. Why would natural selection, you know, gradually create these peahens with these ridiculous and impractical taste in peacocks? There's also the question of, we still have this deep, fundamental, visceral experience of beauty. And do peahens really have that experience? Or are they just counting the, you know, those bright spots on the back of the on the back of the peacock tail. So you still have this thing unexplained, you know, when you see another Darwin explanation. Oh, we like the savannas, you know, these beautiful savannas we see in Africa, is because that's where we first evolved. Well, why do we like rugged? Oh, and that's where we were able to get, you know, game and thrive. Well, what about rugged mountain vistas? You know, what about iceberg? You know, beautiful icebergs. So they have these explanations that if you just kind of focus on that one little part, oh yeah, savannas, yeah, we evolved there, and they leave all this other stuff unexplained. And it's so much more easily explained if you think, well, we are creative. We have, and here we can draw upon theological resources. You know, Ecclesiastes says God has put eternity in the hearts of men. And so when we have this experience of the sublime, the sublimely beautiful, it touches our sense of the eternal. I think that's a much more robust explanation for our experience of beauty than these Darwinian just-so stories.
And the butterfly in particular, I mean, I think that's got to be a very, very difficult thing for the evolutionists if you ever start thinking about it critically, because here you have a caterpillar that produces a chrysalis, and in the chrysalis you have the caterpillar devolving into a mysterious molecular mixture, and out of that comes a being that's the same physically but completely different organizationally. How do you explain that?
Yeah, that's a huge conundrum for Darwinism, that you really need those two forms to evolve simultaneously. Because if you just get one, say, oh, we'll evolve the one, then we'll do the other later. Well, the one by itself can't survive and reproduce. It's not dead on arrival, but the clock's ticking on it. It won't have generation after generation. So you somehow have to evolve these simultaneously. And each of them is extraordinarily sophisticated with all kinds of steps. Far more sophisticated than, say, you know, the bacterial flagellum, which Michael Behe made famous, this amazing little microscopic rotary motor that there's no easy way to explain how it evolved. But, you know, the butterfly, far more difficult. So there's a great film, by the way, we've done some films, Discovery Institute, with Illustra Media. Some of them they've done independently. Some of them they've done with a little bit of help with us. Some of them we've done, you know, together, like The Privileged Planet. I co-wrote that with Ladd Allen. But they have one called Metamorphosis that's about the butterfly, and it's terrific.
Yeah, it's one of my all-time favorites. We've been promoting that at the Christian Research Institute for years. I mean, you know, it's one of those DVDs that you watch with your family and no preaching is necessary. You just watch it, and you know there is a God.
Right. I mean, that's one that you could hit mute and still get a big chunk of the message. I mean, don't watch it on mute, but it's just, you know, all the beauty you see, and you see all the slow motion captured stuff. Yeah, it's terrific.
I'm dying to talk about the Hobbit party, the vision of freedom that Tolkien got, the West forgot, particularly in our political climate today. This is an incredible book. But first of all, talk about Tolkien. Why should Christians be reading his work today? And what are the benefits on a broad level when you start talking about economics and political theorems and so forth?
Yeah, Tolkien's a tremendous writer. He was a Christian. He was Catholic specifically. And he brought that worldview to his writing and to his intellectual life. He was one of two or three men that was key in bringing C.S. Lewis to Christianity, and they were close friends there at Oxford and fueled each other. C.S. Lewis inspired Tolkien to continue working on his Lord of the Rings work, and Tolkien, you know, gave him a lot of great insights that inspired him to do his Narnia series. So now Tolkien was not a fan of that, the allegory of being highly explicit. So you're not going to have, like we have with Narnia, you're not going to have a lion that, you know, a 12-year-old could figure out, oh, this is Jesus. But Tolkien's worldview is just shot through with, you know, his Christian understanding of man, of the fall, of the divine. And so when you have wizards in that world, as you dig back and find out what the backstory is, they're a type of angel. So it's not some kind of witch, dark magic stuff. Now, there are evil figures, and they're demonic, and some of the big ones you find out are you know, have in their backstory something demonic. But there's a very clear line of what's good and what's evil. The hobbits, you know, all the main characters are, of course, you know, imperfect, but you have the main hobbit characters that are trying to live well, and then in terms of economics, Tolkien was a big proponent of limited government, of economic freedom, of you know, humans having the dignity of their own freedom, but then also rule of law, order. You see that in the Shire where the hobbits live. They're not perfect, but they have property rights. They have freedom. They have minimal government. So there are a lot of lessons economically, politically that he buries in there, and also the temptations of being attracted to power. You know, the whole ring of power, the one ring to rule them all. It's the whole book, The Lord of the Rings, is a meditation on the corrupting effects of power. I mean, he could have begun Lord of the Rings with that quote from Lord Acton: "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely," which is maybe the conservatives, you know, first dictum.
Sort of an open-ended question here, but what's going on in our country today? Where are we headed from your perspective?
Oh, that's a huge question. There's so many different threads. I mean, there's some good stuff going on. There's some, you know, that we have with the social media. We have people able to connect. You know, I love that I can connect with, you know, friends and family that I would otherwise be much more difficult to connect with. But we also have people getting on, you know, and just screaming at each other, and creating all this anger. I do think there's things going on that don't get enough play because they're positive. You know, I talked about, you know, some of the positive things happening in Latin America. That doesn't make the news. And so I think it is important to also look at the gains. You know, I think it's easy for conservatives to think, oh, back when, you know, so-and-so, everything was better. You know, back in the 50s, everything was grand. Well, we've made some real progress in certain areas, you know, with race relations, for instance. I feel like in some ways we've taken a step back recently. But we need to take the good with the bad and not, you know, fall into the... And remember that we live in a fallen world. And so we need to work where we can. Don't give up. But don't get discouraged because somehow things don't look like, you know, an episode of Father's Knows Best or something.
You know, that's interesting that you bring that up, and particularly in light of our conversation on Tolkien, because, you know, he was writing in a time where real freedom was unfashionable.
Yeah, it was weird because they defeated Nazi Germany, which was this weird amalgam of socialism and nationalism. And then, of course, the communists were coming in from the other side, and they were able to kind of hold them at bay, at least in Western Europe. But a lot of the European countries became enamored with socialism. It's almost like, wow, we almost got beat by Germany. If, you know, the United States hadn't ridden in, we might have, wow, maybe Germany's onto something. I know there are complicated threads about how socialism took off, but there was this strong impulse toward you know, very, you know, command and control economies, and Tolkien's, you know, kind of stood in the gap against that, and also stood in the gap against the growing secularization in Europe, which, you know, continued apace. But he planted seeds through his work. He could have just given up and gone and smoked his pipe and grumbled in a corner, but he found a way, used the talents he had. We each of us have different talents. Used the talents he had to plant seeds for freedom. I mean, I, you know, how many people have read his works, have read C.S. Lewis's works, and maybe not fully understood the fiction, but had certain concepts or ideas, certain ideals planted in them that they might not otherwise have even been aware of. You know, the concept, what does a free, healthy town or city look like? What does a ruler, you know, Aragorn, who from Lord of the Rings, who constrains his power, who, you know, Frodo with the ring of power, who constrains and makes every effort not to use the power to become his own little god, his own little dictator. So there's lessons there, and they, rather than kind of rolling over and just despairing and kind of retreating to a bunker, they found a way to keep making a difference. I think Tolkien, I won't get it exactly right, but he said, you know, in this life, there are no permanent victories. God, of course, is orchestrating a permanent victory, and through Christ, there's perfect victory over sin. But, you know, in terms of culture, you know, we're not going to, we're going to get to a place in the United States where everything's going to be, we're going to win, and it's all going to be good, and we can just relax and go home. No, you know, each day, each year, you wake up and you strive for freedom, for justice, for fairness. It's too easy to imagine that you can get to the end of it and rest. That's just not the case.
You are a former English professor, and you've been in this conversation, probably because of my emphasis, but you've really been emphasizing the fact that we have to do science well. But as an English professor, I'd like you to weigh in on the fact that we have to do scripture well. In other words, we have to learn to read the Bible in the sense in which it is intended. And if we don't do that, then we're going to negate the value of the Bible. There are so many kids today going to school, and immediately they think the Bible, once they get into the educational process, has to be bankrupt in an age of scientific enlightenment, because you go to the very first chapter of the Bible and you find flaws. And if there are flaws in the first part of the Bible, then the whole superstructure is bound to fall. For example, the days of creation in Genesis. It seems to me that what's going on there is people want to make a chronology out of that rather than recognizing that this is chirological. In other words, God is explaining his purposes in creation. So they start reading Genesis in this wooden literalistic fashion, and then they end up jettisoning the Bible because they have a misperception of what the Bible's really communicating.
Yeah, and that's, it's not just in Genesis. And by the way, I've got some, you know some very thoughtful people that take a young earth view, and they say, you know, God's made the world look older than it is. And I respect them for that. But if you look at Genesis, it's hard to get to come away with it. If you read it carefully, if you look at the Hebrew, come away and be able to be certain that's what it's teaching. I mean, you have these days, but you don't get the sun and moon till day four. I've heard it said, the day always refers to 24 hours. Well, I can't give you the exact verse, but I think within the first couple of chapters of Genesis, there's at least one example where day is clearly being used to mean something other than a 24-hour day. You have the only psalm in the 150 psalms that's identified as a psalm of Moses. Moses emphasizes that for God, a day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as a day. I'm paraphrasing, which to me is curious. The one psalm that's labeled as by Moses, Genesis, first five books of Moses, he's pointing out God's time is not our time. So I think there's enough there, even if maybe you can't come away and say, oh, yes, there's certainly not 24-hour days, enough there that there should be a modesty about what God's trying to communicate there. What I think is clear, and you put your finger on it, God is saying, I am the creator. I am the Lord and master of all creation. If you're worshiping a sun god, you've got the wrong end of the stick. I created the sun. I created light. I created fish. If you're worshiping some animal, I created the animals. I think we have to be very careful and very modest. As my friend Doug Axe, he's a biologic, he's the protein scientist that showed that you can't even evolve a novel new protein. He said, when you look up, if you go out on a clear night, you look up in just the right place, you'll see a star that's not actually a star, it's the Andromeda Galaxy. And it's the one galaxy you can see with outside our Milky Way that you can see with the naked eye. So it's millions of light years away. And so you look at that and that light seems to have traveled for millions of years to get here, because we know the speed of light. And then you look at Genesis, and just a quick surface reading of it seems to suggest that, and as you look at the generations that come after that, seems to suggest, a universe that's just, a few thousand years old. He says, what you do there is you recognize that I'm either misreading the physical evidence somehow, or I'm misreading or I'm overinterpreting the evidence from Genesis. So you bring a humility to both of those, and you let God's book of nature and his book of special revelation of the Bible inform and sharpen you. And we've already done that. Even the most conservative reader of the Bible has done that. There are verses in Joshua and elsewhere that superficially suggest that the sun rotates around the earth. Nobody thinks the sun rotates around the earth. No sane, minimally literate person thinks the sun rotates around the earth. We understand that the earth rotates around the sun. And then as you go back to that having been proved definitively by science, we go back to those scriptures and we realize they're not teaching that the sun rotates around the earth any more than Hank Hanegraaff, when he goes out with his wife in the backyard and says, "Boy, that's a beautiful sunrise, honey." You're not advocating that the sun is actually rising and making its way around the earth. You're describing your experience from that perspective. So when the book of Joshua talks about the sun, stopping in the sky, which is another miraculous thing we could talk about. How did God do that? That we may not know this side of the Jordan, but you realize that he was just referring to this from that particular perspective, the experience you have as you see the sun up in the sky. So, and there are other examples like that. So if we bring a modesty to both the way we interpret scripture and the way we approach nature, we're going to avoid some of these clashes. And then, of course, also a lot of it's just the bluffing from the evolutionists, the materialists, who claim, oh, we've proved, the biggest one is, oh, the Big Bang disproves God. The Big Bang is the biggest headache the atheists have had in the last 100 years. It pointed to a universe that came into existence out of nothing. They hated it, and yet they try to present it as if it's somehow a problem for theism. It's just the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, going back to this argument that some make that there's no standard for measuring time until the fourth day, so the creation days could not be literal 24-hour days, seems to me that the Genesis creation days are there to help us remember and recall the history of creation through an association with the continuous seven-day cycle of life. And what I was driving at here is simply that when you look at Genesis with the literary prowess of Moses, if you start looking at that critically, I mean, it's overwhelming. You start to realize, wow, this guy is a genius, and he's using mnemonic devices. You sort of alluded to these generations. I mean, you have 10 generations before the flood, 10 generations after the flood. That ought to be a clue that this is not sequential, but it's symmetrical, kind of like what Matthew is doing with the 14, the 14, the 14 in his gospel. So the point that I'm making is that we have to do literature well. We have to start reading the Bible not in a wooden, literalistic fashion, but in the sense in which it is intended, because if we don't, everything's going to turn up nonsense.
Right, and we have to avoid an either-or fallacy. This is, either you read it in this one particular way, or you see it all as so metaphorical that it doesn't mean anything. Well, those aren't the only two options. You can read the Bible carefully and get clues from the Bible itself about how it's intended to be read. We don't see, say, for instance, some of the parables of Jesus as history. We see them as fictional stories he made up to make a point. And we're not suddenly becoming postmodern and relativistic when we do that. Some of the poetic language and some of the Psalms, same way. So we have to be careful and not, go to one extreme or the other. But to be careful, that means we have to listen and tend to the Bible carefully, and that takes skill, it takes patience, it takes modesty. And we're not always going to land in the same place, but if we come at it with modesty and care, we're going to avoid some of the most, these big clashes that have divided us and caused us to, draw blood, Christian among Christian.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think on the other side of the coin, you have these people like Bart Ehrman that are looking at passages like Christ's parable of the mustard seed and saying, look, Jesus Christ could not be God because he thought that the mustard seed was the smallest seed. If he was really God, he would have known that an orchid seed was smaller than a mustard seed. And therefore, Jesus was not only a false apocalyptic prophet, but he didn't know what he was talking about when it came to just simple biological realities. And so he's taking a parable and he's making the parable walk on all fours. And as an English professor, that's got to make you want to pull your hair out.
Yeah, you got to look at context. You got to look at how, I mean, Paul does this, Jesus does this. You know, any writer that's being expressive in a compact, elegant way does not nuance every little. What if Jesus is? Look at the mustard seed, the smallest seed in the typical Jewish garden. Parentheses, though, being divine, I'm aware that blah blah blah. The Bible would be seven times as long. It would be dull. And so there's a compactness to the Bible that asks the reader to bring the common sense to bear, that they're not nuancing to death every little thing. And there's, you know, plenty of evidence of that. You know, like when it says there was a famine throughout the whole world, when it's talking about Egypt, well, there's plenty of evidence that the writers, of Exodus, you know, the writer of Exodus knew that the world was bigger than that famine area. But he was talking colloquially. This whole area of, you know, this known area of the world, there was this terrible famine, and he's not going to bog us down by, you know, giving a paragraph or two of telling us every little detail about how far it went and what he didn't know. So, yeah, you need to. It's the concept of generous reconstruction. That doesn't mean when you go to a passage, doesn't mean you always give him the benefit of the doubt and always, you know, ignore anything that's funny, but you. You go at it thinking, oh, this is a brilliant, effective writer, and there's a lot of wisdom here. So what would be a way that I could explain this that would generously reconstruct in a sensible way? And you'll often find the answer. And if you can't think of it yourself, you'll often you'll just do a little time poking around in online commentaries. You'll soon, oh, okay, yeah, hadn't thought about that. I heard somebody say, well, whales... You know, Jonah couldn't have been inside a fish because, you know, whales have, you know, chemicals that eat you up. Well, first of all, I didn't even say it was a whale. Second of all, God is the creator of the whole universe. And so if he wanted to stick, you know, if he wanted to stick Jonah inside a guppy, he could do that. I know there are some people, you know, moderately conservative that say, well, that's actually a parable. I think it's literal. But yeah, there's just, they ignore some pretty obvious, you know, counter arguments when they make these, you know, and you get people like, oh, Daniel couldn't have been written when it was because, well, it was written like 150 BC or 100 BC. And, well, how do they know that? Well, if you dig, it's because that they're assuming that Daniel could have made these amazing prophecies. And so, you know, Matthew had to have been written after 7 AD because Jesus couldn't really have predicted the fall of the temple. So that's where you get the naturalism, the materialism, philosophical materialism, going in and infecting and misshaping, distorting the critical scholarship of the Bible.
Yeah, and it's critical to recognize that the Bible, particularly apocalyptic parts of the Bible, are replete with this figurative language that differs from literal language in which words mean exactly what they say. I mean, the figurative language requires us to use our imaginations to comprehend what the author is driving at. But this isn't any different than what's going on in Lewis or Bunyan or Tolkien. You have to use your imagination. You can't simply take that language in a wooden literalistic fashion. Otherwise, Jesus would be a lion.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think a mistake that some very thoughtful Christians have made is they've seen the crazy stuff that skeptical, agnostic, evolutionary type scholars have done with the Bible. They said, well, if they're going to do that with the Bible and explain everything away, I'm going to go over to this other extreme and, you know, put my post in the ground, and I'm not going to budge. Problem is that doesn't get you closer to the truth, and it doesn't get you close to a true, highly defensible position. Always, it may feel safer, but it's not. You know, God wants us to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. It doesn't mean we can all be brilliant Bible scholars, but He does want us to bring, you know, what capacities we have. Mental, emotional, etc., to our engagement of Scripture.
And the humility that you talked about. You got to give the writer the benefit of the doubt. I mean, Moses, when you go through the book of Genesis, you realize that this is a genius author at work, obviously inspired by the Holy Spirit. So when you come up to a particular conundrum, rather than throwing them under the bus, you got to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it is, there's some, the commentaries that really tease out some of the literary beautiful stuff he's doing. You mentioned the generations, you know, 10, you know, that's a mnemonic device. You have 10 fingers, you know, who knows, maybe, you know, Jewish, you know, kids were taught to memorize on their fingers the 10 generations from Adam to Noah, and then from Noah to Abraham. There are mnemonic devices in the Psalms. So we know that the Jewish writers were fond of mnemonic devices. So, and then you have, of course, the 7 days. I think it's sad that we've lost the mnemonic, in some ways, the mnemonic device of that 7 day structure. You know, whether you see them as literal 24-hour days or as something else, I don't usually wake up on a Tuesday and instinctively think, oh, this is day three, this is the day, you know, because we ended up naming them after pagan gods, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, Thursday, and we lost that. I wish there was a way. I think it's Portuguese that they've kept them connected to the numbered days. I'd be curious to talk to somebody from Brazil or Portugal who's a faithful Christian. Ask them, do those days resonate with you in the first chapters of Genesis in a way that they don't with us?
Yeah, and when you talk about your 10 fingers, I mean, it's not only talking about the genealogies, but I mean, think about the fact that Moses takes your 10 fingers and uses them, just as you mentioned, it's a memory device, it's a mnemonic device. And so with one hand, we can recall primeval history, the accounts of the heavens and the earth. So you have Adam and Noah's sons and Shem and the father of the ancient Near East. And with the other hand, we remember the accounts of Terah, who's the father of Abraham and Ishmael and Isaac and Esau and Jacob, who's called Israel. So Moses is laying out his themes in such a way that the people that were listening to him in an oral culture could not only hear, but could remember and pass it along.
Yeah, and I think that's also, I mean, the one of the evolution arguments, oh, well, it's not a science book, and so he couldn't have explained evolution. Well, actually, evolution isn't that hard to explain, the basics of it. But what he was doing, it wasn't, oh, these people are too dumb to understand, you know, that the universe is so-and-so old and there was common descent. I think he didn't explain those things because there wasn't common descent, and he didn't explain the fact that the universe appears to be as old as it is, because that wasn't his primary function. He had bigger fish to fry, bigger theological and historical matters to convey in a very, you know, compact way. And as you point out, it's an oral culture. So we might want the book of Genesis to be a three-volume set, but that would not have done any service to that oral culture that needed to be able to get as much of that, you know, the important key stuff in their heads and be able to carry it around, or be able to, you know, pull out a scroll, which were, you know, tremendously expensive, and be able to capture it all. So it's very concise. There's reasons for the concision of Scripture, and that's just one of several things you have to keep in mind when you're like, why didn't they tell us more about this? Or why are they skipping generations, you know, here? Why is there, in Matthew, there's, you know, 42, and in Luke, there's, you know, 72. What's going on here? Is Matthew, was he, you know, smoking something and forgot them? No, let's be generous here and think about Matthew, who was a tax collector, knew how to keep account of things, and think about why he may have done that. And he wasn't trying to mislead. He wasn't incompetent. You know, there's the series of 14s you've probably told your listeners about at some point. It's another way of capturing kind of the key periods from, you know, from what was it, from Abraham to Jesus. So there's lots of wonderful examples like that to the Bible.
Yeah, it's done in an absolutely incredible fashion. It's built around Israel's quintessential king, David. So it relates to the vowels in David's name. But, you know, the attempts to read scientific paradigms into scriptural passages have given Christianity one black eye after another. And more often than not, it all boils down to this whole literary thing that we started talking about. It's a misunderstanding of the art and science of biblical interpretation. That's what's at the root of the problem. So you have these churchmen many, many years ago who are teaching teaching that the earth was stationary. So they're using Psalm 93, I guess it was. The world is firmly established. It can't be moved. But that's not the intent of the passage. If you look at the context, then you realize that if you're going to read this as a whole in a wooden literalistic fashion, then you're going to have the Lord robed in majesty, and you think that maybe that's a comment on his clothing.
Right, yeah. And the other thing that gets left out of those stories are, those silly medievals and Renaissance Christian scholars. But those guys were defending the standard dominant scientific view of the day. So they were being like the theistic evolutionists now who want to defend Darwinism because that's the dominant view and try to reconcile it with Christianity. They were actually doing the same thing. They weren't ignoring the dominant science. They were defending it, and it was guys like, you know, Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler that were pushing back and saying, no, I think we need a new scientific paradigm, and God is the creator of all things, and he, you know, the earth participates in the dance of the heavens. That's an amazing thing, and there's an order and beauty there. It's not in conflict with God as the creator of all things. They, of course, got a lot of pushback, but eventually they won the day, but it was Christian scientists doing that. They're reading the book of nature carefully, and they were reading the book of the Bible modestly enough that they said, let me not go too far with my assumptions about what's meant here, that I can't also tend to God's book of nature and listen carefully to it.
I could talk to you forever, and I don't mean that in a wooden literal sense. You're one of the most interesting people in the world, and that's exactly what we do in the Hank Unplugged podcast. We try to bring the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet to people, and I think we've done that today. I have one other question for you, and that is, what are you working on now? I know you're working on lots of stuff, but what's your focus? What's your goal?
Well, that's a good question. Mahdi and I are still trying to promote our book because, you know, it's only been out a little bit, so appreciate so much what you guys are doing. If any of your readers, you know, get a hold of the book and read it and you love it, please, you know, do like with your podcast, you know, go on to Amazon, in this case Amazon, and you know, leave a review, leave a positive 5-star review if you love it. That's really helpful, helping us get the word out. Then also, we are working on a series of video shorts because, you know, a lot of young people, they don't read books a lot. They do watch a lot of, you know, YouTube videos. Fortunately, there are plenty of young people that do read books, but some of them, YouTube video, that's where they're at, internet video. So we're doing a series of video shorts making the case for intelligent design, whether it's in astronomy, whether it's in biology, whether it's origin of life, the supposed ape-to-man evolution issue. And we're going to try to make it very accessible, but also very scientifically precise. So hopefully we'll be able to start rolling those out about one every couple of months here in the fall. It's going to be called Science Uprising. So that's still a ways out, but keep an eye out for that, Science Uprising.
Oh, that's cool. I can't wait for that. I have appreciated your time so much on the Bible Answer Man broadcast and now on the Hank Unplugged podcast. Thanks so much. I mean, you're amazing. When I look at the breadth of knowledge that you have and the things that you've written, the things you've produced in film, it's simply overwhelming. You're using your gifts for God's glory, for the extension of his kingdom. And I say this oftentimes, I don't mean it as a cliche, only from the perspective of eternity will you know how many people you have impacted, and I'm one of them.
Thanks. That's very encouraging, Hank. Thank you.
God bless you, and thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Hank. God bless you and your work.
Thank you. And again, Hank Unplugged is a podcast that is making a difference all over the world, but partly because there are so many people that are helping us make a difference. They're going to iTunes. They're leaving us a 5-star rating. They're sharing the podcast with other people. I hear about this everywhere I go. When I'm in other parts of the world, I hear about the Hank Unplugged podcast. And, you know, the wonder of it all for me is I didn't even know what a podcast was. Now I've done over 50 podcasts, and they're impacting the lives of people again on a global basis. So you can make a difference. You can make your mark by simply going to iTunes, giving us a 5-star rating, and tuning in to the next edition of Hank Unplugged. So long for now.